Hello, I'm Carla Nappi, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I just finished talking with Tong Lam about his new book, A Passion for Facts, Social Surveys and the Construction of the Chinese Nation-State, 1900 to 1949. That's just out with the University of California Press, and it came out in 2011. Now, we tend to take for granted that we have bodies, that we have physical bodies that are measurable. If I were to ask you how tall you were, how much you weighed, or how old you were, you may not want to give me an honest answer to the question, but you wouldn't be completely shocked by the nature of the question itself. Lam's book explores the practices and the technologies through which these kinds of questions and this kind of way of thinking about what a body was and how it related to other groups of bodies and collectivities and ideas of society became possible in the context of China in particular during the first half of the 20th century. He looks very closely at the construction of what he calls the Chinese nation state through censuses, through social surveys, through diaries, through fiction, and through other kinds of social and political technologies. Now, this is a fascinating and very rich and very focused study that's not just interesting from the perspective of Chinese history, although it certainly is, but also from the perspective of anyone who's interested in the history of science, the history of social science in particular, and the history of modernity. Hi, Tong.
Hi, Cara.
We're here today to talk with Tong Lam about his really interesting recent book, A Passion for Facts, Social Surveys and the Construction of the Chinese Nation-State, 1900 to 1949. Now, this is an exceptionally rich work. It's one of those books that you can sit down and read in a couple of sittings, but it's so full of stories and anecdotes and really fascinating studies of primary sources that even as a scholar of China, I didn't know about. It's wonderful. And it analyzes the rationale, politics, and passions behind the production of facts, especially social facts in early 20th century China. So thank you, Tong, so much for agreeing to talk about your book today. I'm really excited to talk more with you about it.
Thank you for having me here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So, Tong, could you start us out by saying a little bit about yourself and your background? Sort of what brought you to academic study of Chinese history?
Sure. I currently teach at the University of Toronto as a historian of modern China. And I did my PhD at the University of Chicago. And I was originally from Macau. And I did my BAs in economics. So somehow I thought that people who study economics are people who are interested to studying political economy, but I obviously misunderstood the whole discipline. So somehow in that process, I ended up becoming a historian. And interestingly enough, turned out that my first book is actually talking about facticities and empirical evidence.
Right. That's perfect. So how did you come to work on this particular topic for your first book?
It was in the graduate seminar in my first year at Chicago when I was working on a set of primary sources in one particular county in North China during the land reform projects. I looked at a set of census and social investigations, and I was fascinated by the type of information that they collect and the type of information that they put together about the present societies in these particular counties. And particularly, I saw some of the information such as the actual properties that people owns in each household. And I found it's really interesting, for instance, that animals was counted up to like each one in exact terms. So the household, for instance, would own like half of the house, a quarter of a cow, for instance. So I found really the position of those information, and this, and then this really led me to ask this question of what is going on here. It's no longer about the actual data themselves, but it's the obsession with facts and facticities.
Right. That's wonderful. And you knew that from your first year in graduate school.
Right.
That's amazing. Wow. Well, this very much is the kind of question and the kind of really fascinating insight that emerges in the course of this book, which is all about the production of something that we tend to take for granted now, which is the very idea of a fact. Right. I mean, how does the idea of a fact as an epistemic concept emerge in different local contexts? And this is a book that looks at that in tremendously interesting detail in the context of the early 20th century in China. Now, this is, if we can kind of jump right in and get right into the book. You start out in the introduction by setting the stage for the rest of the work to come. And so the introduction kind of introduces the fact that the book is going to look at as you mentioned, the emergence of the idea of a concept of a fact, and looks at the production of these facts and the way that the production of these facts, as you bring out so nicely in the book, really transforms the nature of governance and makes the human world knowable and manipulable and sort of countable in ways that weren't possible before. And this is really based on a study of, or largely based on, among many sources that you look at, a study of these social surveys and censuses that you alluded to when you were talking about how you got into this topic. To sort of get us into this, you mentioned that you mentioned that there exist more than 9,000 surveys carried out in China between 1927 and 1935. Is that right? 9,000. This is not to say that you looked at all of them, obviously, but.
Right, right. And I think that was, a movement that was tremendously important that I think we have kind of overlooked until now, because when I look at those information, I just found out that realized that in fact that, you know, every kind of material, secondary materials, are somehow alluded to that they are collecting facts about Chinese society at the time. And so it was a huge operation.
It's amazing. And after you set the stage by introducing this larger set of arguments, and we'll continue to look at these arguments in more detail as we get into the book, you talk about not necessarily if we're talking about social facts, not necessarily the fact part of it, but you start off by talking really interestingly about the social part of it. And you say early in this introduction that the emergence of society as a site of political discourse was really connected with the rise of social surveys. So for our listeners, can you talk a little bit about this idea of society as it was brought into China, and the really interesting history of the translation of this terminology and the way it came to play a role as a concept in early 20th century?
Yeah, sure. And I think I have to backtrack a little bit about how this project came into being in the first place. When I first tried to do something about social surveys, I was initially thinking about writing something on the construction of society. As you know, Chicago is really the place for doing this kind of work for South Asian scholars. A lot of work has been done on census and statistics and the production of ethnographic knowledge in the case of India and other places. And so when I conceptualized this project, I was really thinking along the same lines and thinking perhaps I can write something about how the social work in China came into being. And I think that was the initial question. But as soon as I began this project, I realized that there was another question that has to be investigated and understood. It was essentially the question of facts and facticities. Because after all, when they are talking about investigating society, there's an assumption that that the society is an object that can be investigated. There are things that can be observed. So in other words, there's another question just exists prior to that. And particularly in the case when I look at the Chinese cases and a lot of the sources that I use, and I was struggling constantly in between these two questions. Am I writing about the history of facts in China, or am I writing about the construction of the social in China? So this remained to be a major tension in my work, and certainly during the entire dissertation process. And so this comes to the question about the construction of the social and society. And I think what is particularly fascinating in this moment of time in Chinese history was that the notion of society, or particularly how we translate society, is a term, 社会, didn't really exist in China until the end of the 19th century. In fact, there were competing concepts, competing terminology that tried to translate this concept society. And so I started with that particular point and tried to suggest that, in fact, the different terminology have different implications. And so that's the sort of, in a way, that sort of start out the context, one of the conditions, and say on how society as a concept, as an object of investigation, actually came into being.
Mm-hmm. Right. That was really helpful. Thank you. Now, in the course of this discussion and in the course of the introduction, the chapter very helpfully introduces really a wealth of secondary and theoretical literature on, you know, a range of subfields. So ranging from the history of science, colonial modernity, ideas of facticity, ideas of society, and all kinds of other topics. Can you talk a little bit about some of the literature that you found particularly helpful, or anything that's really stood out for you in shaping your ideas for this book?
In some ways, a lot of these ideas and arguments that you just mentioned, they all play a very crucial role in conceptualizing these projects. And when I was, again, back to the dissertation stage, and I was thinking about how do I position myself in relation to those bodies of literature. So that's really much trying to position this project in between those debates. And particularly, I think, because I feel that there's a huge vacuum in Chinese historiography that not many scholars have actually worked on those areas. But at the same time, I also found myself getting myself into trouble precisely because I try to address so many issues simultaneously. So I think that, again, you know, I it was a productive process, but also it's a tremendously challenging process. And in terms of the particular debate, and I think certainly the whole debate of colonial modernity was crucial, because I think a lot of scholars, until very recently, like to think about Chinese history in terms of this approach of China-centered approach, right? Only looking at China in isolation, relatively speaking, and trying to look at the long-term continuities, and arguing that, in fact, that, you know, without the colonial encounter, China would be moving in a certain way anyway. Mm-hmm. And I kind of appreciate their argument to a degree, because in a way that was trying to moving away from the earlier approach of thinking about China was simply reacting to the West. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, as I argue in this book, in fact, you know, the actual story, it was far more complicated. And I think, I do think that many scholars now are increasingly moving beyond these older debates between the so-called, you know, the Fairbank approach to China reaction to the West, or the China center approach. But there is a way in which we can actually think about how certain ideas and practice actually circulates. And China was part of the story.
Absolutely. And in your, because you've mentioned that this project has had such a long germination stage for you, right? I mean, you really began thinking about this in graduate school. Is there any moment that sticks out in your mind as an aha moment? Is there any individual piece of secondary literature or any specific author who really struck you when you read their work as offering a really key, crucial insight for the way you were thinking about your own project?
No, it wasn't really one particular author or a set of literatures. I think that's really, again, come back to the very starting point. I was thinking about this in relation to several bodies of literature. But I think there was moments that there's certain kinds of primary sources, perhaps we can talk about later, that somehow, you know, make me feel that, oh, you know, I found something interesting here and there. But for conceptually, I think that was a project that has been always been something that I've been thinking about and revising along the way. And I think also during the process of writing this book, new scholarship also came into being. I remember even the very last moment when I submitted the revised transcript, the manuscript, just before I submitted the revised manuscript, I read Anne Stoller's book along the archival grains, and then realized I'm talking about something rather similar, not identical, but rather similar. And I was really glad that, in fact, someone was talking about it in a whole different context.
Mm-hmm. That's a great book, too.
Yeah.
Is that always the way it works? It's like right after you send off the page proofs, then you discover a book that you think would have, you know, completely changed the way you would have thought about things. I don't know, at least many of us who have written books, I'm sure, have experienced that. So as a historian of science, I have to ask, because what really struck me here really pleasantly, and I was really fascinated by your treatment of the transforming and transformative idea of science as it emerges in the context of the early 20th century in China. And it really plays a very important role in your story. So I'll ask you kind of more specific questions about that later, but can you say a little bit about the importance of the idea of science as it shapes this story for our listeners?
Yes, I think I can address it at two different levels. One, I think empirically, science become a very important claim for this particular generation of Chinese intellectuals. And it came with certain kinds of connotation. In some ways, the claims of science and the connotation that came with it remain to be rather important throughout the rest of the 20th century. China, in fact, even today. So I think in a way that sort of, I was looking at the very beginning moment in which how people use claims about science, scientific claims of universal truth and so forth to make an argument about their vision of society. But in a different level, like conceptually, how this body of literature in science studies actually inform my work. And I think one of the very basic assumption that I agree with a lot of the scholars who work in science studies is that when you are witnessing a major political and social upheavals, we are also witnessing a major restructuring of knowledge itself. And I think the story was very much that story in the Chinese context.
Mm-hmm. That's a really eloquent way of putting it. Great. Thank you so much. So this introduction really sets up what's to come. And you go on in a series of chapters looking at particular case studies that really develop and broaden and enrich this story and move us forward. So let's dive into the next chapter. So this chapter opens with a quotation by Mao Zedong from 1941, in which he discusses the idea of seeking truth from facts. And this idea or this term really plays a large role in the chapter to come and really the book to come. Late Qing and Republican practitioners of surveys also use the term seeking truth from facts. And can you talk a little bit about what this term meant in the context of early modern scholarship of evidential research or Kaozhang research, and how the meaning of the term changed for late Qing and Republican scholars?
Yeah, sure. In the early modern period, when they're talking about seeking truth from facts, was essentially looking at the text itself and try to search for theological and textual evidence to authenticate the text so that to make sure the text they're reading are in fact the correct text. By reading the correct text, the argument goes is that, and therefore you can understand the moral principle that were left behind by the ancient sages, right? So you go back to say, how do you know that what you're doing is in fact truthful? So you have to go back to the text itself. And that statement has remained relatively constant. In other words, that, as you said, the Lei Qing scholars as well, the early Republican scholars continue to use that particular statement to describe what they were trying to do. But by the late Qing time, certainly by the second half of the 19th century, increasingly when they talk about seeking truth from facts, they are no longer looking as a textual evidence. They're talking about statistics, actual empirical evidence of all kinds. And then you can see that even more obviously in the Republican period that you can talking about, they were talking about archaeological evidence, sociological evidence, ethnographic evidence. And so then facts essentially were a totally different kind of empirical evidence that could still be textual, but most of them were no longer about theological evidence. They could be artifacts as well, and could be very abstract data such as social statistics. And the type of truth that they were looking for was no longer the kind of moral principle from the sages, but instead they were thinking about trying to understand the mechanisms of the nation state, of society, or cultural formations. So in other words, they were looking for or thinking about a whole different kinds of realities and facts was to try to find the patterns of those social and political mechanisms.
Great. Thank you so much. And this is such a fascinating piece of scholarship also, because you really start to see how the field is changing, right? And I mean, sort of the field of the historiography of China. I mean, there was a time not too long ago where the discussion was about, you know, Chinese concepts versus non-Chinese concepts. And I think this is a great example of you're really doing a lot to move way past that dichotomous way of thinking about the history of science and history of knowledge by really showing how even within Chinese documents, right, even this term that has been identified as kind of paradigmatic of Chinese scholarship, the seeking truth from facts, itself gets changed and transformed and translated even within the context of what we retrospectively identify as trans-historical China.
Yeah, I think the impact of the story, I think that's sort of also one of the themes that went through the entire book, as you said, is also how sort of the older concept and category being reconfigured for a contemporary and modern purpose. And I think one of the footnotes to that, to the statement about seeking truth from facts, when I was working on this book manuscripts, I spoke with several colleagues, and some of the colleagues who work in different, like more contemporary fields, they said, well, seeking truth from facts, so you're talking about Deng Xiaoping, right? So I think that's also that, you know, it's kind of interesting. For this historian, at least for modern historians, sometimes we have forgotten, right? That in fact, that a lot of this thing, didn't just start off in modern era. In fact, you can trace it back in the much older, earlier moments, even though they meant something else.
And it's also really enlightening for those of us who do work on the early modern period, or what some of us call the early modern period, to see the way that these terms that we're familiar with from, you know, 16th and 17th century texts really get taken up and translated and transformed in the 19th and 20th centuries. I mean, this was fascinating for me to see this later history that, you know, I'm familiar with this in the context of early modernity. So this was, I learned a lot from this. So right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Now, as you bring out really beautifully in this chapter, this reappropriation and translation of this idea and the way that this ultimately contributes to the emergence of a culture of fact and facticity in China isn't happening in the context of China in a vacuum. So this, you situate this within the formation of what you call a culture of fact in Europe that to some parties and in some levels made China seem lacking in comparison. Right. So there's this kind of relationship between what's happening in China and sort of looking at what's also happening elsewhere. Can you talk a little bit about this context of what's happening in China in this period with a broader, in the broader story of what's happening elsewhere? Because it's not just this emergence of a culture of fact in Europe that you point to, but also you talk about how the development of survey-based social science in this period in America also helped shape what's happening in China.
Right. And I think, first of all, the emergency of the culture of facts, in the case of Europe happened, it took place a little bit earlier.
Right.
By the time in which China, I really sort of, spend a lot of time, at least in my conceptualization of the project, to make sure that I don't present a story in which China really lacks certain kind of facts and sort of catching up with the European. So I think that was one of the things that you can probably see in the chapter itself. I play with this, different types of empirical evidence a great deal. And what I was trying to do is suggest that instead was that the apparent absence, the apparent lack of facts, was essentially came from the colonial gaze. But now suddenly in the global colonial context, there's certain kinds of facts and certain way of thinking about the human world became the dominant mode of thinking. And so the absence of that particular mode of thinking, trigger a whole range of emotional response from the Chinese intellectuals. And so I think that was one of the things that I really was struggling with myself as well, because as I was working on this, and I wasn't entirely sure that, you know, how do you deal with the question of like the Chinese empirical evidential research, for instance, empirical, there was a pact of empirical research prior to that. And so I'm losing track of your question.
Oh, no problem. It was thinking about how to situate what's going on in China within a larger context, even if you mentioned the importance of survey-based social science in America and how that's actually
that's right.
has a relationship with what's happening in China at this time.
Okay, so I hope I can restart this particular section.
No
I was a
problem.
Bit confused by myself as well. I think, okay, first of all, I think that the moment of this, the rise of the social survey or survey-based social science around this time was not a unique Chinese experience. And I think a lot of this thing was already happening in the late 19th century all over Europe, certainly in the United States too, that you have a story of a social survey movement as well. In fact, that particular term social survey movement was used by American historians themselves with describing the rise of these particular types of social investigations. So in many ways, so China was sort of became part of this global story, but also it played out very differently in the local context, precisely because in the case of China have a long tradition of having some kinds of empirical practices, and evidential research being the center of that in the early modern period, right? But suddenly, I think at the turn of the 20th century, a lot of the Chinese intellectual sort of begin to react to the accusation that was made by European and American observer who claimed that China didn't have facts or empirical practices. And that triggered a range of emotional responses. And for me, that was one of the major driving force of the Chinese social survey movement. And I think that was the difference between the Chinese example and the American case. At the same time, I do want to emphasize that, in fact, as I said, that you do see a lot of similar practices and operation all over Europe and other places as well. In the case of Europe, for instance, in France, for instance, there was also Foot-Love movements, anthropologies and sociology, going out to collect, empirical facts about, or ethnographic facts, right, about, different parts of the country as a way of constructing, their imagined community. So I think there was sort of similarity going on as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. So now that we have this broad context set, you take us into very specific ways in which this actually starts manifesting in China in really, really fascinating set of examples. And so one of the things that really struck me as being very important to this rise of the fact and this rise of facticity was the importance of numbers and numeracy as it sort of becomes translated into political language. And as you put it, I think political literacy, I mean, even to the point of reshaping Chinese bodies that get redefined in terms of quantities and measurable characteristics. And there's this really great image of children being measured and sort of scaled in the book that I think makes this really powerful. Now, as part of the story of numbers being really important, there's a discussion in here of a very particular number that took on a tremendous significance for a lot of people in this period and really brings out the kinds of emotional responses that you allude to, and that's the number 400 million. Can you talk a little bit for our listeners about the importance of this number 400 million to estimate the Chinese population at this time?
Yeah, I think there's different kinds of discourse about the notion of 400 million. And I suspect that the original ideas would probably come from the missionaries themselves who make an estimate of the Chinese population. And in fact, during this time, Western observers often have difficulty to obtain the exact number of the Chinese population. So there were debates about that. But the debate itself also implies that the China really didn't have any kind of specific forms of census that was able to produce accurate information about populations. So around this time as well, and for many Chinese nationalists and Chinese intellectuals, 400 million become a metaphor that stand in the size and the scale of the nation. Right? And having 400 million, I think Xun Yat-sen, Xun Zhong-san, also used this term to suggest that this is the size of the social body. That, so some people would argue that in fact that, you know, that having 400 million is creates some kind of boundaries. It's like people who belong to the imagined community or people who are being excluded from it. And what is also interesting is that you also have Manchu Bannermans who argue that, you know, there were 5 million Manchus within the 400 million Chinese social body. So part of this argument is that the 400 million was a number that is really not about the exactitude of the numbers, but it's really the metaphor of the social body. So whether the Manchu Bannerman was included in it, they were still thinking about this as 400 millions. And then when they were being excluded from it, it was still about 400 millions, right? But at some point, around that time, increasingly you have social scientists, including one of the person that I mentioned in the book, Li Jinghan, for instance, begin to argue that, in fact, that, you know, the population of China remains to be 400 million for such a long time is an indication that, in fact, that China didn't have social statistics. It didn't have census, or at least accurate census, right? So that was then that become a metaphor that's no longer about the strength of the social body, but it's about the lack of social statistics, the lack of science, and the ignorance of social facts. And I so you can begin to see the shift of the discourse surrounding the concept of 400 million.
That's right. That's great. And thank you so much. And this Li Jinghan example is one of the many points in this book that upon reading it once, it's going to stick with me for a long time. There's this fantastic quote by this intellectual on page 35 for listeners who haven't read it yet. And that really, I'm just going to read a tiny little bit of it just to give you the flavor of how powerful this use of the 400 million number as a critique is. He says, "When I went to elementary school at 6, the Chinese population was said to be 400 million. And the expression 400 million compatriots could be heard everywhere. By the time I graduated from elementary school, the Chinese population was still 400 million. When I graduated from middle school, I read my younger brother's geography textbook. It still said our country's population was 400 million. And then he goes on and he graduates from university and reads his little niece's textbook. He returns to China after studying abroad and looks at textbooks. And it's always this 400 million. And it's just such a great quotation that just embodying this critique. Now, this is Li is one of many intellectuals in this period that you write about who are critiquing this lack of exactitude in Chinese society. One of the other ones is someone who many of our listeners may have heard about, but perhaps not in this context. And this is the figure Hu Shi. He did this in part with a story from 1924 called Mr. Chabadua. I loved this description. I loved your description of this story. So can you talk a little bit about Mr. Chabadua and the importance of this figure in this story for our listeners?
Right. So Mr. Chabadua was a story that I think many kids in China, even today, they probably still grew up with their stories.
Really?
And yeah, I suspect that's the case. In fact, I was just discovered a pop song in Taiwan rather recently, even though it used the same name, Mr. Chabadua, even though the contents is, you know, has nothing to do with the original story. But I think that somehow that the term sort of have its own life as well. But in any case, this is a figure that is very consistent with a lot of what the Western observer describes about the so-called Chinese national character, right? Mr. Chabadua was someone who doesn't have a sense of exactitude. So anything that is almost about the same, then he's always okay. He's kind of easygoing, but at the same time, so he was one of those person who sort of embodies, you know, in a way, the so-called Chinese national character, in a way that you can show that he's precisely someone who doesn't have, you know, any interest in facts or science for that matter. And so I think the story, oftentimes, you know, as we know, that it end up with the story where he end up dying, because he was sick. And so, and he asked someone to find a doctor for him, and then someone ended up finding a doctor that was not, was treating animals, not humans. But because the surname was about the same, and then they said, well, it's fine, it's about the same. And then so he ended up dying. But before he died, he said, well, you know, whether he's dying or he's staying alive, it doesn't really matter. It's about the same. So it somehow is that story, that was being presented by intellectual like Wuxi in this case. Again, it really suggests that there's a whole generation of Chinese intellectual really sort of begin to move away from what I call the sort of society, right? That was, society has now suddenly become an object of investigation. So increasingly you see intellectual like Wuxi or Li Jinghan or Lu Xun for that matter, really become, assuming at least partially the colonial gaze.
Listeners, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but sure. you brought up Lu Xun, and that was another moment I wanted to ask you about. Right. Can you describe that moment also for our listeners? Because it's a very kind of famous and very trenchant moment that you describe here, of when he decides to change his career path.
Right. I think for people who work among China, they all know about the story about Lu Xun. Is that because when he was, according to his own description, of course, when he was in the classroom and studying medicine in Japan, and he realized that the sick social body, Chinese social body, you can't just cure the bodies, because by looking in the particular instance in which he cited, it was according to him, that was the teacher in the classroom was showing a slide in which a Chinese was being executed by the Japanese soldiers. In this particular slide, it shows that other Chinese people were surrounding and watching the execution, apparently, you know, was laughing at it, right? So the political apathies become an issue for Lu Xun, who finally concluded that he can't just become a medical doctor to save the bodies, but he then began to argue that in fact that, you know, it was through the technique of literature, through literature, that he wanted to save the soul of the Chinese people, right? And I think that particular story is really well known. But when I was working on the sources, and I found another very interesting moment was actually come back to Li Jinghan. He had a very similar moment, and he actually described in a classroom that was in the U.S. when he was taking classes about social statistics. The teacher actually asked him about statistics about China, and he was not able to provide any information because there was no Chinese statistics according to him, right? So he said that he was very excited about this class at the very beginning. He's always tried to sit at the front row of the classroom, but eventually, because every time when he was asked this kind of question, he was not able to answer, and he felt become very shameful about the fact that he cannot provide any statistic about China, so that he ended up sitting in the back of the classroom hiding from the teacher itself. And I thought the story itself was really fascinating in a way that, because it somehow almost sounds like Lu Xun's story was being retold by a social investigator. And it's the absence of facts or the idea of the lack. China was lacking something and they therefore have to catch up. But as I said, all these intellectuals sort of begin to stand away from the larger public and say, well, we have to look at China from the outside and try to awaken the people so that they also begin to realize that China was lacking something. In this particular case, so lacking the attitude of science, the notion of facts and exactitudes.
Right. And you talk about this in the context of what you, following Spivak, call epistemic violence.
Right. And so the argument there essentially then saying that, unlike the South Asian cases where you actually have a colonial administration who actually, impose, social science, statistics and the whole way of thinking onto the colonial, on the native population. In this particular case, you don't need to actual formal colonies. You don't have to occupiers. And yet this discourse of deficiency, of lack, was tremendously powerful. It was so powerful that in fact it compelled the Chinese intellectuals to repeatedly retell the story of lack, right, as a way to try to awake the people.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much. And there's a lot more in that chapter also that I'll point listeners to, but we'll move on to the next one. For now. Now, you move from this really rich story to focusing in on the national census that took place between 1909 and 1911, which marks the beginning of a movement to produce facts about the social world. And you do a really great job here of comparing this to earlier Qing systems of census taking, like the Kangxi atlases. Can you say a little bit about what the major differences were between these earlier Qing systems of census taking and this national census in the early 20th century for our listeners?
Yeah, and so I think that was certainly that when European and American observers saying that China didn't have census, that was not true at all. In fact, that China have different kinds of census that exist all the way throughout the entire imperial period, right? And then one of the census that I particularly mentioned was the census the beginning of the Ming Dynasty, in which they was actually used troops to carry out a particular census in a very massive scale. But one of the major difference between the earlier census and the census that emerged in the beginning of 20th century was that the earlier census actually make up of a whole range of practices. And so as we know, the Qing, now many new Qing historians have begun to argue that in fact the Qing wasn't exactly a Chinese dynasty, right? It was make up of different regions with different constituencies. So we can actually see the similar practice in census. For instance, you can see there's a different way to deal with the banner population. There's a different way of counting the Muslim population. There are different ways to account for the people that was along the frontiers, both inside of the empire or even outside the empires. And then with the China proper, that was also using a very specific type of census to count those population. So my argument there was that intentionally that the Qing census. It shows in fact it was a very flexible form of governance, right? It really deal with different constituency in a different way. The new census that emerged in 1909, on the other hand, insists on counting the entire population, the entire states, using one single template, using one single format. So I argue that's one way that you're thinking about the shift from a dynastic empire to a nation state, in which the social body, right, the population, have to be homogenized in a way that to count in the exact same way, that each one, it doesn't, regardless of your background, ethnicity, or social class, now it suddenly become a citizens of the new state, right, the emerging nation state. So I think that was one of the differences. And the other major differences was also that in the new census that emerged in 1909, the state insists on counting each individual. In the past, they only count certain types of people. Sometimes, I also argue, the absence of accurate census was actually part of the intention, because the older census was tied to taxations. So in the case when you have a natural disaster, for instance, they would just reduce the numbers. So essentially, there's a form of tax relief. Right. And there's a lot of, you know, different things going on in the older census as well. But in any case, it's really not about counting the accurate number. That wasn't the whole purpose of it, for the most part at least. But in the new census, you do see that the state, repeatedly, urge, the official to count the exact numbers of the entire population. And another thing that you also have in the new census is that, it's no longer tied to what I just said, you know, taxation itself, but it's counting the population just for the sake of counting it. And of course, at the same time, there's an implication, because that's linked to the whole, project of establishing the Qing dynasty or the Qing state as a constitutional monarchy. So elections and all these implications, reforms implies that you have to count the exact population so that you can actually implement those projects. So, and I think that's a major shift there.
Great. Thank you so much. And I think you really compellingly make the case here that this is part of a shift where the individual becomes the basic building block of this new social body, right? This transformation in the Qing from a dynastic empire to a nation state, which you, I think, really compellingly show, this is how the individual becomes important in a new way.
Well, and also conceptually, that when you're thinking about a modern nation state, right, because the legitimacy of the nation state comes from the people. So by counting the people, you're essentially making a new claim that you're representing the people. Whereas in the older state, you know, it's no longer about that whole way of thinking.
Right. But as you go on, I think really interestingly to show us in the next chapter, this new mode of counting and this new mode of census taking and for all of its accuracy and new forms of legibility and renewed emphasis on the individual and on direct contact, it's not necessarily embraced unproblematically by all of the people who are being counted, right?
Right.
And so the next chapter raises some really fascinating case studies of souls or fears of soul stealing and issues of sort of problems with actually census taking on the ground. Now, this chapter opens with the story of villagers in 1910, I believe, who burst into the home of a census taker and demanded that he hand over a register of all the souls that he had stolen. Can you describe this this case in this moment for our listeners and talk a little bit about what sort of how this relates to the broader kinds of issues that the chapter is looking at?
Right. I think that's also for me, when I was able to find out those sources, I was actually quite excited by it myself, because and this is one of the areas that was actually didn't exist in the original dissertation. I didn't realize that, in fact, a lot of things was already began before the Republican period. Right. And for me, many people, in fact, that are other scholars from the Republican period who argue that, in fact, that, you know, China didn't have census prior to the Republican period. And even though many of them knew about this Lei Qing census, they kind of dismiss it and say, well, it didn't really happen. They didn't really carry that out in any effective way. And there's a lot of this discussion. And so basically, there's a way to dismiss anything that happened prior to 1911 or 1912. But I think, as it turned out, right after they begin to implement the census in the spring of 1909, suddenly you have a range of protests all over northern and central China in particular. And this is a really protest that was triggered by the census. And so in this particular cases and a few other cases that in which the census takers being accused as soul stealers was often misunderstanding that in which some of the people who were being counted by the census takers through the contacts, right, in the actual process investigation, that some of these people eventually died. And in one case, for instance, that you have the whole family who actually died, probably because of contentious disease after they have contact with the census takers. Mm-hmm. So suddenly that you have rumors being spread all over the counties, and in some cases being those rumors being circulated to other provinces as well, and saying that the census taker were themselves actually soul stealers, right? And that was a suggestion that the census taker was actually asking for different kinds of information, because we didn't have this accusation of soul stealing prior to this, even though China have different kinds of census, right? So for me, there was a key indication that, in fact, there was a direct contact between the census takers who were representing the central government, not the local government, and the ordinary people, the villagers. And they were, in fact, asking for a new kind of information that triggered fears, widespread fear. And those protests was extremely widespread, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you. Bring up some of these stories here that people were afraid of soul stealing for the purpose of railroad construction, right? And there were rumors that a person would die in 7 days after they were counted by a census taker. Just really kind of interesting stories here that come out of a context in which you wouldn't think that soul stealing would arise, at least for me.
Right. There was a different kinds of rumors. I think almost like that, every local community have their own, version of the stories. And I sort of looked up some of the earlier, case of, soul stealing. I think historian Philip Crimson, he have, you know, written a very important books about it, much earlier about soul stealing, right? And what I found is really interesting in this case is that, there's almost no exception. All the soul stealing accusation that, emerged during the census reform or the new census, between 1909 to 1911, actually happened in the same cases, same province, in many cases, same county in which the soul stealing panics also took place earlier. Except in the earlier case, the soul stealers, according to Philip Queens, right, were the outsiders, like traveling monks and so forth, who were being accused as soul stealing. And in this new moment, what you have is the accusation of the census takers are people that they already know. They are representing the government, became the soul stealers. And so that was, for me, that's a major shift. Again, it's one of those moments that you can see how older resources, how older cultural or popular belief of being mobilized for a whole different purpose, right? Being reconfigured in this new context. In this case, it's the whole belief of soul stealing.
Right. That's so interesting. And what's also really interesting about this, and I'll just kind of mention this before we move on to another fascinating chapter, but you bring up the work of Louise White, who speaking with vampires is really, really formative for a lot of historians who think about rumor in history. And I think this chapter also makes a really large contribution to this kind of emerging historiography of rumor. And really just brings up a very different way of thinking about what a source is, right? So taking rumor seriously as part of historiography, I think, is really fascinatingly done here.
Yeah, because I think for me, that's really interesting is that I try to respect those accusations, those claims, right? Because otherwise I would be biased against them and basically taking the same position as the state and dismiss this as some kind of superstitious belief. But at the same time, what I found was really interesting is that, again, come back to this as a way to contrast this two moment of soul stealing accusations. In the earlier moment that this was described by Philip Kuhn, at the end, the emperor came in, he stepped in and said, well, we already investigated all these so-called soul stealing cases. In fact, that nothing actually happened, right? By making the claim, the state actually was able to position itself as as the mediator between the spiritual and the secular world. By claiming that, in fact, nothing was retranspassing or transgressing this boundary. But in these later cases, what happened was that, that the state essentially dismissed all these accusations and say this is really superstitious. And for me, that's really ironic because, social surveys and census taking and social investigations, essentially practice that try to collect empirical evidence as a way to understand the social mechanism, to understand the human world, right? So my argument there, in fact, that they, because of this shift from one mode of knowledge production to the other, they actually lack the capacity to deal with this kind of issues. So they actually, somehow they lost the ability to see the other side of the story. And so I think that was really showing you also that, you know, that at the moment in which the social world and the state really being set up as two sides of these two opposite categories.
Right. Absolutely. Now, the next chapter shifts the focus to the Republican period, which for readers who don't work on Chinese history, that's 1912 to 1949. And this chapter explores how research institutes and researchers used ideas of science and the nation to search for a new basis of political discourse and action. And the story here really turns to a fascinating discussion of the ways that researchers conceived the role of science in the reconstitution of China as a modern nation. Now, you talk in this chapter very explicitly about the fact that there is no one definition of science in this context, but can you talk a little bit about what science, in quotes, meant for some of these researchers who are part of the story that you're telling here?
Sure. And I think you're right that at this moment that the science is something that's yet to be defined. But I think what is even more important for me is that the claims of being scientific. Mm-hmm. So the rhetorical was extremely important that for every group of practitioner who are involved in the so-called scientific knowledge productions. Right? And for them, of course, being scientific often means, in this case, of in the context of social surveys, is really to produce what they consider as empirical evidence of the social world. So producing facts for many of them is really about practicing science. But as I try to describe in this chapter as well, that it shows, in fact, that what is being counted as facts itself has to be also has to be investigated, because as it turned out, as in some of the cases that I showed, that you have multiple social investigators who are essentially doing things that are extremely similar in a certain way. At the same time, one investigator could be seen as really being scientific and doing modern social science, and the other one would be seen as a traditional scholars. So for me, a large part of being scientific is really what I call the self-fashioning in the entire process of social knowledge production, that they have to constantly tell themselves as well as others that they are in fact practicing science, even though the actual practice are suggesting a whole different story there.
Mm-hmm. Right. And one of the fascinating parts of this story for me was this debate over the idea that scientific knowledge could be culturally and nationally specific. So you talk about the example of Fusen Yan, who absolutely rejects this as a possibility. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think part of the debate is really sort of argue that the debate between Fusen Yan and his associates and the people who were practicing Guoshi, who argue that you know there must be a Chinese science, right? And Fusen Yan really sort of reject that whole idea that the science is defined by national boundaries, and because for him the claims of science is powerful precisely because it transcends cultural history or the nations. And so he really sort of, in a way, that claims of universality was really, for him, really important, in sticking his position as, a scientist. In this case, even though he's a historian, as we know, that he was, one of the major historians that emphasized on the collection of empirical evidence. Now, other scholars who were associated with national studies argues that you could have science, but there was also something called Guoshi or national studies that was unique to China. And for them too, there was a major shift or major departure from the older scholarship. But even in that debate, what I'm trying to argue in at one level that they were very similar because they're both using science to make claims about their own practice. At the same time, it's also that there's a major differences between them. But at the end of the day, I sort of argue that you know the people who won the debate partly but because that they were able to make certain kind of claims that seems to be more persuasive in that particular cultural context, but also because like people like Fusen Yan, for instance, they were supported by the state. And then so they have the tremendous resources to actually to put forward their agenda of social science.
Thank you. That's really helpful. And it's also a really fascinating case that kind of speaks to a very contemporary debate that those of us in science studies and history of science are engaged in, where the emphasis now is so much historiographically on the importance of the local production of knowledge, right? And so many people want to argue that there are, you know, East Asian styles of science, technology, and society, or Chinese styles of history, and so on and so forth. So it's really interesting to see this kind of argument about the opposite of that coming out and kind of informing this larger transhistorical, you know, context of this set of issues.
Right. And of course, one of the irony too, that when they talk about transcultural and transhistorical, but you do see some of the older practice continue to exist in this, even among the group, that was supported by Fusen Yan, that, you do see, for instance, that, the traditional travel writings, for instance, the particular type of writings, remain rather central in the actual process of knowledge production. But I'm not suggesting this is sort of essentially a Chinese style, but instead I'm trying to suggest that in fact that this is more like, and see how people make claims about the fact that they're producing truthful knowledge, right? So for me, the story bears the actual everyday practice become very important to try to understand exactly what they mean when they're producing scientific knowledge or producing truth or becoming an observer of a reliable observer of the nation states. And through that process, I really sort of begin to realize that, you know, sentiments and feeling become very important in their writings.
Oh, goody. And I was going to ask you to talk about that next. Excellent. So I'm sorry. Go on.
So, you know, that is really one of the central aspects of the book as well, because from the very beginning and say that, you know, the whole Chinese social survey movement wasn't really, you know, it's something that was simply accepting the West, so-called Western methodologies, but it was really driven by, you know, or put it this way, they were not simply accepting the Western methodology because that that particular methodology was superior or self-evident, right? On the other hand, it was precisely because they were driven by a certain kind of emotional needs, right, to fulfill this so-called lacks, to make sure that China, in fact, have the same kind of social scientific knowledge. So you can see that emotion sort of went through the entire book in that particular way. But in the particular case that we're talking about here, that you can actually see particular individuals, how do they mobilize their own feeling, talk about their own feeling, become a very essential part of their process of knowledge production. In fact, they have, as I said, as I show in this book, there was multiple social investigators, right? They actually have to report their own personal feelings to their own institutes and to record the feelings. And in fact, that was just so, in fact, they were suffering. In fact, that they somehow become, they were compelled to believe that they, you know, they're becoming now a reliable observer of the nation precisely because they suffer. And so the confessional mode of writing become part of the process to authenticate the kind of empirical data that they were producing in the field. And for me, that was really sort of very, very interesting, but also shows that, in fact, that you can't simply say that, you know, the Western methodology was actually superior, but there was an actual mechanism going on the ground.
Right. And for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, I'll just sort of mention that this chapter uses a lot of field notes and diaries of researchers to do this in a really fascinating way. And this is just a really compelling set of sources that you give us a lot of background on and excerpts from. And so I really appreciated that. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I have to say that, you know, that was, I probably used only maybe less than 1% of what I have. In fact, that is, you know, as we mentioned in the very beginning, there were so many social surveys being done. Many of them actually have field notes, in part because a lot of those was being seen as a training process. As I said, that recalling one's feelings become one of the prerequisites of social scientific knowledge production. So they are actually required to write down their feelings. Because of so many of them, it's really hard to actually get a handle on exactly what's going on. But I have read also so many that I begin to realize that there was a template. They kind of become very similar if you look at each one of them, and it's almost repeating in the same patterns, right? And I do believe that it's almost like a partially, at least it's like a ritual process in which you have to make the claims that in fact you suffer a lot in the field, so that, you know, whatever you're producing there must be valuable, must be truthful, must be credible.
Wow. And so, I mean, I wonder if you could argue from there that not just is this use of social surveys and training producing modern sort of producing society in a new way and producing fact in a new way, but it's also producing a new kind of way of experiencing and making legible sentiment.
Yeah, I think that would be a fair observation. And also, I would go a little bit further and say that I think I did mention a bit in the book too. It's also a process of producing this observer. Mm-hmm. Become a, you know, who is a national citizen, who are now, you know, taking up this position of being a credible observer of the nation. So you're actually producing a new kind of political subjects in the process as well.
Right. And the and I don't want to take up too much of your time, so I'll move on to the next chapter from this. But I'll also just point out for listeners that there's a really fascinating discussion also that you give us here of the training process for social science researchers at this Research Institute of Land Economics, which was also really interesting. So thank you for this chapter. I loved this chapter. And are you just kind of incidentally, are you planning on doing anything more with this wealth of field notes and diaries that you have that you didn't have a chance to use for the book?
Not at the moment. I hope maybe some other researchers would pick it up. There's a lot going on there.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a fascinating personal archive. I'd love to see more of that. Okay, but speaking of time, let's move on to time. Time, space, and state effect, which is what you talk about in the next chapter. And this, for me, was a really kind of a wow moment in this chapter. This chapter focuses on the 1928 census and its role in creating new ways of imagining time and space and the way they constitute individuals and new types of individuals. Now, in particular, one of the things I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about is the importance, as you tell us, of a sense of simultaneity in constructing groups, sort of mentioning that the census in 1928 placed a good deal of emphasis on the idea of capturing the state of a population instantaneously. So can you talk about this sort of new way of conceptualizing and manifesting time?
Yeah, I think that's one of the starting points for that is a contrast to the earlier census that we just mentioned, the census that came out in 1909 to 1911. In that particular census, the Qing state did not actually specify when the census should be done, and certainly not in a very narrow window. I mean, they wanted to get it done within a few years. But in this, as a contrast, when you look at the 1928 census that was proposed by, the KMT, there was a very strong emphasis on, the needs of carrying out the census, in a very short period of time, by which I mean within several hours. They had to stop all the traffic and et cetera. Now, in practice, it didn't quite happen except in a few cities, particularly in Nanjing. And in most other cases, they were not able to carry out that kinds of operation because the lack of, the inability to control the bureaucracy, and they didn't have direct control in many places in China. Now, but it does imply that, in fact, they're thinking about the population in a different way, thinking about creating a new sense of solidarity, right? This is the moment that actually was not just about counting the people, but it also create a condition in which the people really felt that they were part of this larger social body, that you can imagine themselves in relation to the larger context. Just imagine that you would, if you're going to work in that particular day, particular morning, and suddenly all the traffic stops and everyone was, sitting there waiting to be counted. Right. I think that was the moment that you can imagine that how would one rethink one's social and political conditions. And I think that for me, it was a really important turning point as well. At least conceptually, as I said, because a lot of this thing didn't quite happen the way that the KMT wanted.
Right. Absolutely. So, in addition to talking about the importance of this new way of conceptualizing and physically manifesting a shared experience of time and simultaneity, this chapter also looks at the role of a discourse of superstition, right? And you sort of mentioned this a little bit earlier in our discussion, but you look very specifically at it in this chapter and talk about the way that surveys and these research studies were used to essentially define what superstition was in a new way, right? And to identify certain groups or people as superstitious and single them out for transformation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think one of the difficulty when I was looking on in the history of social survey movement in China was to say, well, what does that all mean to talk about social surveys? Because everything seems to be social survey for them, particularly at that moment. Nothing was really clearly defined. And oftentimes it's also very difficult to track down the relationship of how one set of survey were actually related to the others. But at the same time, if we're talking about this is not just an intellectual shift, but also a cultural shift. We do see this emergency of a culture of fast, in which you do see that there's a range of practice really came into being around this time. And so, so what I wanted to do here was really to show, in fact, that, well, you have talked about senses, but you can also talk about this anti-superstitious campaign, and talk about the kind of social survey that was, you know, associated specifically with that. And so, in this particular case, what is really interesting is that I sort of begin to see the survey itself is actually not about the specific data that they were producing, at least in this particular case, but it's about the process itself. Because the whole practice of social survey essentially introduced a whole different way of thinking about the human world, thinking about the human condition. In this case, categories like superstitious was being constructed, which you also begin to see this category was becoming part of the census categories beginning in 1928, right? And but in this particular set of anti-superstitious campaign, we see a range of surveys being commissioned by the KMT government to target particular groups. As it turned out, many of these people who are being investigated also begin to appropriate the language of social science and say that we're not doing superstitions. This is just a charity operation. So the argument there, therefore, is that surveys become this particular instrument that mediates the interaction between the government and these particular groups who are being investigated. In the process, really transform not just the government's understanding of the social world, but also how these groups and people understood themselves in relation to the government and the states. And so for me, that was the crucial point, as more than the actual survey data itself, but it was a process of transformation, how people begin to, you know, use those survey category to re-articulate themselves.
Right. And this is actually part of, this actually leads perfectly into the final substantive chapter here before the epilogue, which is this chapter where you really look in detail at a concept that you bring up at the beginning of the book, and a concept in which the discussion you just gave us really fits nicely into, which is this idea of China as a social laboratory. Now, a major contribution of the book as a whole, really, is a development of this idea that China becomes a social laboratory in the early 20th century. And there's a lot of really fascinating aspects of this that you talk about in the context of this chapter so that we can not keep you all day, because I could keep you all day. There's so much fascinating stuff. I want to ask you in particular about one, what seems to me to be a really crucial contribution that this chapter is making, which is the point that Chinese social scientists turn their attention in this period from the urban world and urban China to the rural world. And really in the process, you argue, create the very notion of the peasant as an object of investigation. That seems totally crucial to me. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. I think that one of the things, as I said at the very beginning, too, is that I try not to show that, in fact, this is a story about that China simply accepted those practices or methodologies. Instead, what I'm trying to show that China, as it turned out, become the ground zero of the social experiments, not just for the Chinese social scientists themselves, but in this particular case, also for American social scientists. The cases that I mentioned, for instance, you actually have social scientists, American social scientists, who actually use the specific term, quote unquote, social laboratories, and say China is the social laboratory for us. Right? So they themselves, interestingly, didn't see China as a unique case as well. So in fact, in the way that we can actually talk about the diversities of conception and practice of social science, even among the American social scientists themselves, right? There are people who try to essentialize China, but there were people who actually see, well, China is one of the laboratory. But because the size of China, China become very crucial laboratory for them. And then for the Chinese Chinese social scientists increasingly that they first they adopted the American methodology, but very quickly they sort of begin to reject it and say, well, actually we didn't have those industrial conditions that they were, you know, investigating. No, we have the rural society. Yeah. So then you have a range of liberal social scientists sort of begin to, you know, switch to the rural and focus on the countryside. And was in the process, the Soviet category, the peasantry, was being mobilized and appropriated by some of the social scientists. And somehow, it's a process. It's not, I think you still need a lot of further additional investigation in exactly how, but perhaps we could never find a story because so many people are talking about it. At one particular moment, then you can sort of begin to see the terminology of peasant alone mean, suddenly proliferates. Mm-hmm. And whether the liberal social scientists or the communists, they all started to use that particular term to talk about the rural society. But I think that was what is really interesting here, that the rural become the focus of social investigation, actually had an impact for the American social scientists as well. For those who tried to engage China at the beginning, were all also increasingly being convinced by the Chinese social scientists, by the Chinese colleagues, that in fact that we need to look at the rural, right? So their visions of China also was shaped by the Chinese themselves.
Right. And there's, thank you so much. And there's so much also going on in this chapter that I'll just kind of point to for listeners. I mean, you talk about the Mao Zedong's role in all of this. You talk about the surveys that include lots of different kinds of materials, including one that includes the entire script of a play. You talk about turning of social surveys into an anti-colonial instrument. It's just an extraordinarily rich story. So thank you so much for this book. And thank you also for making the time to talk about this today. I know I've kept you for a very long time, so I'm going to give you the opportunity to wrap up by asking, is there anything that we didn't have a chance to talk about today that you'd like to mention in particular for listeners who haven't yet had the chance to read the book?
Well, perhaps maybe just 2 points that I didn't quite mention in the beginning. And I think one of that is that I think for me, the challenge of this particular book was that it's not a kind of conventional institutional history. It's not a biography. It's not an intellectual history that is tracking in ideas. And so for me, from the very beginning, has been a real challenge because I'm trying to talk about the emergency of a categories that change the way we understand the world. So for me, I wasn't exactly sure where do I find the sources, because you don't have a ready-made body of material in the archive, mm-hmm. right, about the history of the fact waiting for me. And then at the same time is that almost anything that came out from that particular moment, as I mentioned earlier, is they're kind of related to the rise of the culture of fact. Mm-hmm. And so where do I draw the boundaries for my research operation? In other words, what should be included, what should be excluded, was a huge challenge for me. So one of these things that eventually what I did was to sort of look at what I call the history of practice. Instead of tracking individual intellectuals, certainly there was, you know, quite a few of them are being mentioned in the book, but I'm not trying to check the life stories that much, but look at how this social investigator actually do the field work in the everyday. And also a lot of the investigators were not major intellectuals. They were ordinary people, educated students or teachers or bureaucrats. And those people's names are not being recorded in, you know, any major history books at all. In fact, we, you know, some of the people, we don't even know their names. But for me, I think it's important to track down the story of their everyday life when they were conducting surveys. So that, I mean, that was one of the methodologically that was a challenge to try to write a history of practice. And I think another very minor point is about one of the central arguments there too, as I already mentioned, I think earlier, that it's not so much about the empirical data that they actually produce, but it's very much with the entire moment of the early 20th century China, or in fact, the first half of the 20th century was really seen as a moment in which the practice of facts or these cultural facts was really gaining traction. In other words, it's really the process of training people or to convincing the Chinese citizens that they need to have knowledge about facts, about their own society, about themselves, about their own body. I think it was that culture being in, you know, instituted. And I think that was a story about that process more than the actual production of facts. As you can see, they're producing all kinds of facts that are often contradictory to one another. They may not, the type of information that they produce at the end may not be commercial, may not be easily be translated in, into actions. But at the same time, that's the moment when facts became a very important things, for Chinese culture.
That's right. So now that the book is out, and congratulations on that, what's next for you? What's your, what project are you working on now, or what's on the horizon?
I'm working on a new project called, tentatively called The Qing Empire Strikes Back. it was really about the renewal of the Qing's imperial ambitions near its end. So that was in fact based on what my preliminary research, at least, that this shows that in fact that a lot of Qing elites, both government officials and as well as educated elites outside of the government, was talking about that the needs of building the Qing into a modern colonial empire. And I think that story, for me at least, it sounds really fascinating because it has a tremendous implication for understanding 20th century China, despite, you know, none of those operations actually, you know, became successful because the Qing collapsed.
Absolutely. Well, I'll also look forward to interviewing you about that book when it's done. So it sounds like a great project as well.
You have to wait for a long time.
Okay. I'll be here. But you should not have to be here throughout all that. So I'm going to let you go. thank you, Tung. We've taken up a lot of your time. And thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today. It's just, it's a fantastic book. It was a wonderful read, and I learned a great deal from it. So thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Bye. Thanks. This is Carla Nappi, and you've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much, and I'll see you next time.